and also his successors, Naima alayhimus salam. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the virtue of not answering every question that one is asked, and also the virtue of saying, I don't know, when asked a question one does not know the answer about. In the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad and his successors, the A'imma alayhimus salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The notion of a civil war in the U.S. might have been unthinkable years ago, but now that is not the case. Half of Americans these days believe that a civil war is possible in the next few years. What are the reasons behind this dark scenario? On this edition of The Spotlight, we look at why the U.S., the country that preaches democracy, has reached this new low, and whether the politicians or lawmakers are even aware that the U.S. is not as united as they think it is. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar joins us from New York. Also joining us, Emeritus Professor of History at Westchester University, Lawrence Davidson, joins us from Westchester, PA.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and let me first start with you, Daniel Lazar. We're looking at a study that has found that about half of Americans expect a civil war to occur in the next few years. 47.8% disagree. Curious as to why there would be a poll, but obviously there was a reason to have this question asked. Why do you think, do you agree with the results? Do you think that that is the case when it comes to your view on the possibilities of civil war in the U.S.?
Well, I think that's, yes, it is the case. We're not quite sure what form civil war would take. It probably would not be a repeat of the one in 1861 to 65 under Abraham Lincoln. But yes, I mean, there's certainly elements of a civil war, of a coming civil war, are looming in the U.S.
Like what elements?
Well, there's just an amazing degree of polarization. Political polarization, and most important, Congress is not functional. It's no longer working. It's, essentially, It's become a battleground, a deadlock for the last generation. Neither side can get its way, and as a result, passions are building up dangerously on both sides.
Which camp are you in, Lawrence Davidson? Do you agree or disagree?
No, I disagree. I disagree. I mean, I do certainly agree that there's an enormous polarization. That polarization, I think, has existed at least from since the 1960s, and probably even before, and has expressed itself in various ways. The civil rights movement, the anti-war movement against the war in Vietnam, Black Lives Matter, all these sort of things. And those things reflect a culture war, essentially. And the backlash to these progressive protesting movements has been the coming forth of white supremacists, and their armed. They've got guns, and that sort of thing. And so they are capable of small, I would emphasize small, little rebellious acts that are violent. Those acts would be almost immediately suppressed. In order to get a civil war, I mean a real civil war going, you need the police to walk off the job. You need the National Guard to refuse orders. And you need the Army, Navy, and Air Force to refuse orders too. That's not going to happen. Even under Trump, it didn't happen when it might have been reasonable for it to happen. So I think that, yes, we will see violent actions and rebellions, but they will not result in a civil war.
Well, Daniel Azar, this comes as the House Select Committee is investigating the January 6, 2021 insurrection. So far, as we understand, 8 hearings have taken place. And one of the findings saying that Trump repeatedly seems like he courted violence following his election defeat. But that was pretty close to just a snapshot of a mini civil war, in a sense. That when you take a look at it from the outside in anyways, because some of the characteristics of what Lawrence Davidson said was present during this insurrection. Do you agree?
Yes, of course. I mean, I'm not sure what the difference is between acts of violence and rebellions and civil war. To me, they pretty much merge into one another. But the point is what January 6th showed was not that we had unscrupulous president in the White House, but the very mechanisms of American government were breaking down. For roughly 3 hours on the afternoon of January 6th, Americans really had no idea who was fully in control. An act of succession where the baton is passed from an outgoing president to an incoming president, I mean, that didn't work. The baton was dropped, and for 3 hours, no one could pick it up. So I think that the structure of American government is falling apart, and I think when that happens, then all kinds of hell can break loose, up to and including a civil war. Let me add one thing. The root cause is a 235-year-old constitution that is effectively unchangeable and has created a government that has not worked in any reasonable democratic fashion in a quarter of a century. So that is the root problem. And even worse, that ancient constitution is simply unchangeable.
Wow. Okay. Lawrence Davidson, your reaction.
No, I agree with a lot of that. I think that the United States government has become, at the federal level, has become largely dysfunctional. The Supreme Court has sort of recognized that and began to pass power from the federal government back to the states, states' rights kind of thing. And there we have a real difference, blue and red, you know? So you might see right-wing supremacists take over state governments and oppress the elements of their state citizenry, who probably would then leave. But that would then, you know, there would be a more legal and federal running around about that. But that kind of thing can happen now, okay? And maybe you will see it. But you know, back in the early 60s, the National Guard of, what was it now? I'm going to get this wrong. One of the southern or middle states came out and protected black kids to integrate a white school, which was unheard of. But the National Guard of that state, following the orders of the president, did it. Now, what you need is a viable president, and you need an election that stops this roadblock in Congress, which your other guest correctly identified. We might be able to do that now because Trump has really modeled what the consequences of not doing that are. So we will see how the various elections play out, the primary elections and midterm elections and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. My feeling is that you were going to break the logjam with these elections. But, you know, I've been wrong before, so.
Well, it's a wait-and-see game there. You know, when you take a look, Daniel Azar, at what, and I'm going to use Steve Bannon as an example because it fits in with what I want to ask, the former White House chief strategist who was found guilty of contempt. Well, he has said that the Biden administration is abetting a criminal investigation or invasion, I'm sorry, of the southern border. And he says the Democrats want to deplatform and humiliate you, the listener of his show. He has a podcast of some kind. And they want to destroy the United States of America. Now, it's not so much about Steve Bannon, it's what's coming out of his mouth and that type of viewpoint. It, coming up from, well, I mean, he was a former chief strategist. You can't disregard that. So when it comes from that position, is that a view that's held by many?
Yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, yeah, I agree with your other guest, Lawrence Davidson, but I think he's just taking a way too optimistic view of the situation in the U.S. The machinery is breaking down. Passions are building up to explosive levels. Either side believes the other is destroying America. Either side believes the other is engaged in a profound subversive conspiracy to overthrow the constitutional system. And this is what this, like these are what lead to civil war, where essentially a civil war is about control the fundamental mechanisms of society. So that's why, and this rhetoric, you hear this rhetoric among Democrats, you hear it among Republicans, it's increasingly violent in tone. And it already has led to violence and will undoubtedly lead to much more.
The name of his, I shouldn't promote his program, but I'm going to have to because the name is there. He calls it the War Room Posse, Lawrence Davidson, and he says that they will become foot soldiers in an army of conservatives who want to destroy the Republican Party, and that we need to crush the Democratic Party, crush, by any means necessary. Again, it's not so much about Steve Bannon, but what he's saying and whether there are others who hold the same view. And is this in large numbers when it comes to people of the high positions?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, what he's doing is inciting to riot. That's what he's doing. And there are large numbers. I mean, I think that my guess is the numbers that are listening to guys like Bannon run to about 30 or 40 million people in this country. Now, if you could solidify that into a violent movement, you'd have a problem. But I don't think you can. I mean, this is 30 or 40 million people spread out amongst over 300 million people. And so it would be very difficult. You can't just do it by talking, right? Anyway, parts of that 30 or 40 million are mobilized, are armed, and might very well cause trouble. I'm just saying that trouble will not rise to the level of a civil war. But the aspect of the government, that part of the equation, that's up to grabs. I mean, if we don't, or we, if the American people don't, break this logjam in Congress and put a strong, active person in the White House, this thing's going to drag on and on. And the more it drags on, the more your other guest will have evidence for what he thinks is coming.
Well, let's not get into who might be a good candidate for that. But let's talk about then what the UN expert has said, Daniel Lazard, back in the year 2020, where the headline read, "Decried near tyranny in the U.S. against minority voting rights." That electoral laws in some parts of the U.S., and mentioned Texas, just undermine democracy. This would be one way that you would have blood levels rise in Americans, especially minorities, which could then break out into the open in a violent way, perhaps. What do you think about the findings of the U.N. there, the U.N. Special Rapporteur?
I think they're absolutely correct. There's no doubt about it. In many states, measures are used in order to inhibit voting by racial minorities, by Black Americans. And as a consequence, the dream of political equality has not been attained because minorities, the poor, et cetera, are penalized in various ways. But that's true for the structure of American government as well. I mean, the Senate is one of the most lopsided legislative bodies on earth. It gives the same weight to rural white states like, say, Wyoming, that it does to multiracial giants like California, even though California's population is something like 68 or 69 times larger. And most minorities live in those big urbanized states that are grossly underrepresented in the Senate. So that is the basic source of American racism, which it's a constitution that was created by slaveholders in 1787. 25 of the 55 delegates to the original Constitutional Convention were slave owners. Mm-hmm. So it's a slave owner's document. And that legacy, even though slavery itself has been abolished, that legacy lives on, and it affects every last aspect of American daily life and is leading to a giant political explosion.
Yeah, we're going to talk about race in just a minute, but I want you to repeat what you said there, Daniel Lazard, the underrepresentation that exists in Congress.
Yeah.
Tell us
yeah.
how many states, because that was indeed one of the findings of this UN Special Rapporteur. Repeat that, please. Yeah.
Okay, 54% of the U.S. population lives in just 10 states, 10 highly urbanized states, California, New York, et cetera. Those 10 states are outvoted 4-1 by the minority that lives in the other 40. In addition, 81% of racial minorities, includes Asians, Blacks, Hispanics, et cetera, also live in those top 10 states. So they are outvoted by a largely white minority in the remainder.
I mean, this is incredible, isn't it? I mean, talk about an imbalance there, Lawrence Davidson. What do you think?
It's archaic, that's for sure. And I would say that that this reflects the culture war that we're in the middle of, because what the image of America.
I'm sorry. Can I just ask you, why do you call it a culture war, or not a civil war? I'm just curious.
Well, first of all, civil wars are violent. Okay, the culture war that's going on, it has not risen to that level. It's a culture between those who are progressive and want to see diversity and equality and all that stuff, and the other group whose image of America is basically, you know, your white male, you know, what, guy in a suit, or maybe not in a suit, maybe, you know, fixing cars or something like that. It's a white man's America. And so you've got that image, and you've got this other image, much more progressive, and it's those two images are competing. And in the Senate, you've got a system, okay, that there's no doubt it's imbalanced in favor of the white suit, or, you know, whatever. So there are, of course, the House is more diverse. And of course, the Constitution itself has many, many amendments that attempt, for better or worse, to modernize the government in terms of the diversity of the citizenry and what have you. So, you know, I think that we're very much in a culture war. And the question is, can it flip over into something more violent? I think it can in places, but the reason I say that it's not going to evolve into a civil war, because civil war is in fact extraordinarily violent situation where the armed forces split, you know, and that kind of thing.
Sure, I gotcha. So, race, minorities, Daniel Lazar, how much, if we were to look at the possibilities of those two factors, or I should say one, the really just one, which is minorities, how much of a factor does that play currently when it comes to racial tensions that would fall into the lines of possibility of a civil war breaking out?
It's huge. It's just huge. I mean, first of all, blacks and other racial minorities are grossly underrepresented at the federal level. So that just automatically leads to them being treated unfairly, unjustly, number one. And number two, the legacies, as I said before, of the slaveholders lives on. So therefore, you know, if you read between the lines, you can see that the document, the American government in general, is permeated by, you know, by assumptions that white people are the real Americans and everybody else is an interloper of some sort or a second-class citizen. I mean, it really is a white man's republic. That's how it was conceived. And that's the way many people still think of it today. And so the consequences for racial minorities are sweeping. I mean, if you look at the prison population, I mean, black people are overrepresented by a factor of 10 to 1, and it's due in great part to the racial inequities that are baked into the system.
All right, the Detroit, Michigan. I'm going to mention some cities, Lawrence Davidson, Memphis, Tennessee, and Birmingham, Alabama, top three cities the year 20. Let me make sure of the year 2021. These are the cities in the U.S. that have the most violence occurring. Homicides to have increased in those cities, and the ranking hence comes in at 1, 2, and 3. I'm not too sure if you're familiar with those three cities, but obviously they're very violent. And those are scenarios where forget the word civil, it's just violence, people getting killed, you know, now for a variety of reasons. And there are many cities that have areas like that, especially in cities that have projects where we know how dangerous those projects can be. Has the U.S. turned more dangerous as the years have gone by?
Yeah, it has. I mean, the rule of law has been withdrawn from many areas in most cities. This has something to do with the divisions within the police department, black and white, the attacks on the funding of the police by minority groups who feel that they're being oppressed by these guys.
Right.
And the ability to reform the police.
All right. I'm sorry, Lawrence Davidson. I have to jump in because we're fresh out of time. I do apologize. Okay. Lawrence Davidson there, Emeritus Professor of History at Westchester University. Daniel Azar, thank you so much. Great information there from him, journalist and author from New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. وَإِذْ نَادَى رَبُّكَ مُوسَىٰ أَنِ ائْتِ الْقَوْمَ الظَّالِمِينَ
And mention when your Lord called Moses, saying, Go to the wrongdoing people.
قَوْمَ فِرْعَوْنَ أَلَا يَتَّقُونَ
The people of Pharaoh, will they not fear Allah?
Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 10th verse of chapter Shu'ara. إِذْ نَادَى رَبُّكَ مُوسَىٰ أَنِ ائْتِ الْقَوْمَ الظَّالِمِينَ قَوْمَ فِرْعَوْنَ أَلَا يَتَّقُونَ When your Lord called out to Moses, saying, Go to the unjust people. The 11th verse, The people of Pharaoh, will they not fear Allah? In this regard,
we said that this chapter covers 7 different stories of the great prophets. And this chapter is using these stories as an instructive lesson for all the Muslims, especially the early ones. Anyway, it begins with the story of Moses. Although there has been many events in the Holy Quran that the story of Prophet Moses has been mentioned, but it seems that these instances are following different aims. Anyway, at first it says, وَإِذْ نَادَ رَبُّكَ مُوسَىٰ أَنِئْتِ الْقَوْمَ الظَّالِمِينَ. And when your Lord called out to Moses saying, go to the unjust people. And then the Quran adds, the people of Pharaoh, قَوْمَ فِرْعَوْنَ أَلَا يَتَّقُونَ. Will they not fear Allah? The point is worth studying that here the only tribute of pharaohs that is emphasized is their tribute of dhulm, them being the companions of dhulm and dhalama, and oppression. We know that this word has got a comprehensive and extensive meaning, and polytheism is one of its manifest extensions. Because the very Quran we are studying says that verily polytheism is a grievous iniquity. So Quran adds polytheism as one of the most important instances of iniquity and dhulm. So it is called oppression. Anyway, Almighty Allah tells Moses to go to these unjust people. Why do they not fear Allah? They were oppressors. They were unjust people, as the Holy Quran says, and slavery of the children of Israel with those harsh punishments and tortures is its other extension, the extension of unjust. Moreover, before anybody else, they first oppressed themselves with their wrong actions. And so we can summarize the purpose of Divine Prophet's call in struggling with oppression and tyranny in all aspects. Anyway, at this time, Moses, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi wasalam, tells Allah his great problems and difficulties and asks him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, to strengthen and boost him more for carrying out this great mission. This is how the Prophet Moses answers Allah. قَالَ إِنِّي أَخَافُ أَن يُكَذِّبُونَ. And Moses said, O my Lord, surely I fear that they will reject me. We'll be back after a short break. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, dear listeners, when the Almighty Allah tells Prophet Moses to go to the unjust people, and ittil qawm al-zalimeen, this is how he answers, "My Lord, surely I fear that they will reject me." قَالَ رَبِّ إِنِّي أَخَافُ أَن يُكَذِّبُونَ So, Moses implied that they would defeat him with their other oppositions, with their denials, before he could complete his mission. And he was worried about about completing this mission. He was worried that this mission could not get anywhere near done. And he had the right to be worried. Why? Because Pharaoh and his people had so much dominance over the conditions of the country, namely Egypt, that no one could struggle with them. No one could oppose them. And thus, any little opposition would be harshly and tyrannically suppressed. Moses was worried about this, that the order and commandment of the Almighty Allah would not be completed. So at first, he asks the Almighty Allah, and he is asking him for help. Why? Because إِنِّي أَخَافُ أَن يُكَذِّبُونَ I fear that they will reject me. I'm not worried about my own life. I'm not worried about my family. I'm not worried about my wealth in the first place. But I'm worried about the fact that they might not accept my invitation to you. This is how Moses answers the Almighty Allah. Dear listeners, we will continue this story in the Holy Quran in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets of this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always was for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Verets, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. on the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist. After he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mira Tervets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism. They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. But like the old saying is that the other one's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter. And hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
As the United Nations is pushing the warring sites in Yemen to renew the truce, the Sana'a government has set new conditions to accept the extension for a third period of 6 months. The head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, said the United Nations is now required to ensure the payment of all salaries which are suspended since 2016.
If the leadership in Sana'a accept the extension of the truce, the commitment under the agreement should be implemented from the first day of the truce. The blockade must be lifted by land, sea and air. All roads must be opened, and the salaries of Yemeni employees must be paid. The oil wells must be preserved, and the suffering of prisoners should be ended. Without this, the truce has no meaning.
Experts say it is likely that Sana'a rejects the terms of the current truce and pushes the United Nations to further ease the suffering of Yemenis by dispersing salaries.
It is clear from the political and military statements of Sana'a that they will not accept the request to extend the ceasefire easily. There are new demands by Sana'a to enter a third period of the agreement. The United Nations must fulfill previous commitments and deal with the new conditions positively. Otherwise, there will be a military escalation.
Yemen's demands come against the backdrop of United Nations' failure to force the Saudi led coalition to fulfill its commitments under the current agreement that was brokered by the world body in early April.
Disappointing and useless, that's how Yemenis describe the current UN brokered agreement. They say the Yemeni army should be prepared for different scenarios, including military escalation.
Due to their decision to sanction Russia over the unrest in Ukraine, France and the European Union are desperately trying to build energy stocks ahead of this winter. However, a record heat wave has created a surge in energy consumption, and that's prompted the government to informally call for the rationing of electricity. Citizens have been pushed to make an effort by cutting off Wi-Fi, unplugging appliances, and going without air conditioning. Many in poor neighborhoods say they expect their streets to go dark earlier and for their social services to be affected first. The West's sanctions campaign against Russia continues to force the average household into paying a steep price.
It's very difficult to see this crisis getting better by 2023. Finding alternative sources for gas and petrol will cause higher prices. Renewable energy will be more expensive. France isn't a big coal producer. France is already depleting its petrol and gas stocks. So every choice away from Russian energy is going to increase energy prices.
In order to have more control over the national energy grid, this week the government announced that they will totally renationalize the company Electricity of France. The energy giant runs all of the nation's nuclear power plants. Nuclear power provides nearly 70% of France's energy, the most of any country in the world. But a recent series of outages have caused nuclear power output to drop to its lowest level in nearly 30 years. Leaders of French energy corporations recently said that energy cuts are certain for this winter and that prolonged cold spells may threaten social and political cohesion.
The best solution is to negotiate with Russia to end the war in Ukraine. But we also need the leaders of the European Union to stop living in an isolated fishbowl where pushing for more war is a good idea. This energy and economic crisis is affecting all citizens.
A proposal to give the European Union the right to impose mandatory gas rationing across the bloc's 27 member countries was immediately shot down by the nations of Southern Europe this week. They called it the farthest-reaching power grab by Brussels this year. And it was especially controversial because individual national vetoes were not allowed under an emergency procedure employed by the leaders of the European Union. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
I'm heading with pro-Russian forces to the front line, just outside the city of Donetsk. We move at a fast pace, as there is constant incoming and outgoing at these positions. Suddenly we are told to run as we reach open ground. The pro-Russians had just fired a heavy artillery barrage. The Ukrainians will most likely respond in kind. We reach the trenches. Opposing them is the Ukrainian stronghold of Adievka. For 8 years, the Ukrainians have been digging in, creating a complex network of underground bunkers. It will be one of the greatest challenges for Russia in this war so far. This fighter is an Abkhazi volunteer from the south of Russia. I asked him why he came to fight in Donbass.
It's our common sacred task to stand by Russia. We understand that an unjust war is going on. This territory is Russian land. Unfortunately, NATO and the USA are trying to make use of the collapse of the USSR. And you see the results of this work. Unfortunately, people die in war. And Russians and Ukrainians are fraternal peoples.
Now, about a month ago, I was in a frontline position not far from here, and it was pretty quiet. Now, the situation has changed as the pro-Russian forces here are trying to move forward into different positions. The Russian army is far to the north of here. There's a feeling that before making a full push, they will wait for the Russian army to come down and help to encircle Adievka. But for the moment, they're trying to keep the Ukrainian positions occupied. That's why there's so much incoming and outgoing from this position. While NATO and Ukraine have been declaring for months that morale is low this side of the battle lines, all the pro-Russian fighters I've spoken to over 2 months here clearly have high morale. They are in no doubt they will take Adievka soon, as well as the rest of Donbass. And they believe they are fighting for a worthy cause.
They know perfectly well Russia doesn't target civilians, so they set up their positions where civilians are. We have sympathy for these civilians, but we will liberate them. And for those who forced the Ukrainians to fight for the Nazis, we do not have any sympathy. The card, as ever, was played by the Americans. It should be realized, Ukraine doesn't need this war. Their minds are not clear. They were left no choice but to fight by NATO.
While Ukraine is putting up a fierce defense in Donbass, the advantage is Russia's, with its overwhelming artillery superiority. As this conflict approaches its sixth month, soldiers are dying for each kilometer of land. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Five rounds of voting by UK Conservative MPs have produced the final two candidates for party leader. It's now down to Tory party members to decide who will be the next leader of not just their own party, but the country too. The finalists, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, are lining up for their final showdown to become Boris Johnson's successor. The winner set to be announced on September the 5th, following a vote among the 160,000 or so members.
While members have been given a full month to vote, experience from past similar postal ballots suggests that many members will probably decide on who they want to vote for immediately, casting their ballots as soon as they get the chance to do so. So that means that the two candidates will have to rely on a rapid, hard-hitting initial start to their campaign in order to try and grab as many to their side as they possibly can.
The Conservative dogfight has raised concerns within Tory ranks that bitter divides are being exposed to the public, further damaging the party's overall image.
The comments made in the debate were really more personal in nature and really relating to people's performance and particular minutiae of policy. There aren't really substantial differences in the Conservative Party. There may be slight disagreements on, well, you shouldn't have put the taxes up, or you should have originally been a Leaver, but now they're all signed up to taking Britain through the Brexit process, which, contrary to some, is still continuing because there's unfinished business from leaving the European Union. But really the differences are slight and have been somewhat exaggerated.
The two candidates must now travel across the country and tackle questions from members. With the economy in crisis, party reputation on the rocks, and even greater issues with foreign policy, whoever wins will have serious work to do. Robert Carter, London.
They can make people laugh, impersonate voices, or sing. The stage for talents. The 5th International Stage Stars Festival brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey, to get on stage and perform in Iran's city of Rafsanjan.
I come from Bangladesh. I have participated in the hosting section. It's an amazing festival for the likes of me who pursue their dreams.
I am participating from Iraq. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to show my talent here in this event.
I have to represent our culture, Indian culture, and when I was in the start in the Tehran, then how I managed to live, because I didn't know the Persian language.
The contest has four categories of singing: stand-up comedy, show hosting, and sound impression. Contestants say this stage provides a shortcut to their success.
I'm so happy to be able to take part in this international talent contest. It provides a great opportunity for stage talents to be seen and shine in their favorite fields.
Stage Stars is a good chance for singers, sound impressionists, and stand-up comedians to be discovered. It's a big leg up for them.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say only their real talents will be picked for the top prize.
This is a competition between the professionals of stage performance. There is no chance for a mistake. Each contestant here has a strong background in their expertise, so this stage is not the starting point, but a milestone for their careers.
One interesting part of this festival is the participation of international talents, who are mainly students from other countries who study in Iran. There's a separate competition dedicated for foreign participants.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival. The top performances from each category will win the golden mic, plus a cash prize. Organizers say this contest seeks to scout for those who really have a knack for stage performance and to bring them under the spotlight. So to those who nab the golden mic here, this stage is a springboard toward their ambitions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
The European Commission is asking EU member states to reduce demand for gas by 15% until spring. For now, this is just a request, but the Commission warns it might well become a demand.
The 15% are aspirational. It's a voluntary goal. It's aspirational. And in case that we are in an emergency, then the target becomes binding.
The EU claims it's concerned that Russia will cut off all gas supplies in retaliation for sanctions imposed by the West over the war in Ukraine.
Shortfalls will not just affect the countries where the shortfalls happen. They will affect every single member state because they will have serious consequences on our economy. And nobody can escape that consequence.
The truth is, Russia has fulfilled all its energy supply contracts to the EU and vows to continue doing so. Some analysts believe the US and its transnational companies are behind the hysteria because they want to take business from Russia's Gazprom Energy Corporation.
The whole rhetoric today is based on imaginary threat, which was never confirmed by Russian authorities, because on contrary, Russian authorities said on many occasions, and including the President Putin, that Gazprom will honor their contracts.
Since Russia's so-called special military operation was launched in Ukraine last February, the EU has been importing large amounts of liquefied natural gas from the United States. It's an expensive process. The bloc is also signing contracts with countries in Africa and the Middle East. During a technical briefing here for journalists, officials confirmed to me there has been no contact with Iran on increasing EU energy supplies, despite the Islamic Republic having enormous oil and gas reserves. In this regard, analysts say the EU continues to bow to US pressure, and it's ordinary citizens who are paying the price for that. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
You don't have to be a financial expert to know your pound just isn't going as far. The price of everything has gone up. Living in the UK has become more expensive.
I've had to cut down on a lot of stuff. I can do shopping only maybe once, twice a month because finances are not that great. See, most money goes on bills, petrol, to get the kids to school, come back and, you know, make sure the house is in order because obviously the kids have to eat.
We've seen a dramatic increase in it whereby we could go and spend X amount, and that would be for 7 days. We're now going, actually, that's not even covering the whole week now.
The things contributing to the high rate of inflation, soaring energy, fuel, and food prices, driven by a number of factors.
Those causes are very often related to Ukraine and Putin and the war, because what we know is that has pushed up gas and electricity prices. There are also transport costs have been going up. Because of logistical problems following the coronavirus. Then, of course, we've got the problem of Brexit.
And the worst is yet to come. Britain's central bank has warned price rises could hit 11% later this year, but will come down in the year after. Experts say the UK could be at risk of recession.
The Bank of England's got it wrong as usual. So it will come down, but it will be much more persistent than anybody is anticipating. And to get it back down to 2% could take at least 3 years, not two, not one. And it's going to take a long time, actually, because it's now embedded in the system. And people will want to catch up. You see, the public sector, they're going to take a big real wage cut this year, probably, but they're not going to tolerate that the following year.
The government says one way to contain inflation is to suppress wages. Prices are going up, but incomes are not keeping up. That has meant sweeping rail strikes over demands for higher pay. Some public sector workers, such as teachers and medics, have received a pay rise, but below the inflation rate.
These are tough times for everybody, but it's those on the lowest incomes who are feeling the pinch. According to one study, more than 4 million, that's one in six British households, are worse off now than they were last year, a number that could change come the coal season. Saeed Purizab, London.
Illegal and politically motivated. That's how angry protesters describe a Swedish court ruling sentencing Iranian national Hamid Nouri